episode of the Here's Johnny podcast. I am your host, Larry.
And I'm your host, Justin. Feels like a long time since we've recorded one of these, Larry.
Recorded live. We've had episodes. Just for those behind the scenes, Justin was on a well-earned vacation with his wife and family, so he was off the grid, even more so in Canada than usual.
Yeah, you're not wrong.
But this week, we have a very special episode, as you can tell from the title. We have actor John Tagg on for an interview. We talk about his career. We talk about hypotheticals and horror and beyond. And it was a really, really fun conversation.
Yeah, he was really, like, really nice and open about, like, everything.
Yeah, it was a blast to talk to him. So enough from us. We're going to go ahead and sit back, relax, and enjoy our interview with actor John Tagg. Very special interview episode with John Tagg. John, go ahead and say hello.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
So our interaction started on Twitter because I saw you were looking for more followers.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, you want to come on a podcast and talk? And then now here we are. So
excellent. Well, problem solved.
I'm excited to hear about you and to kind of just talk, introduce you to our audience. And okay. As always, the first question we ask everybody, what is your favorite scary movie?
Ooh. Wow. Well, there's so many. I guess my favorite scary movie, the movie that still scares me the most or still like gives me that unsettled feeling the most is The Shining. And I think that a lot of that just has to do with, well, first of all, you know, the Stephen King and just Kubrick's style is still, it was so classic and yet still so modern at the same time. Mm-hmm. And the performances are incredible in that film. But yeah, I think The Shining is probably, I have to put that up there as one of my favorites.
It's a good choice.
But there's so many.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up in the 80s, so, like, I grew up with all those classic horror films, like, you know, Halloween and then Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street. And, you know, I was at that age where, you know, when you went to the video store, you get those VHS cassettes and you wouldn't even know what the film was about. The cover was so cool that you would just, that one looks cool, let me get that one. And, you know, it's like I spit on your. Sit on your grave and you come home and you play for your mom and dad and you're like, oh shit, this is not. I'm sorry about the swearing. I'm from
no
New
you're
Jersey,
good nope so you're totally fine.
I tend to swear a lot, so
nope, it's all good.
I swear, I hope I don't offend anyone, but yeah, so I mean, I grew up in that time where those films were really fun to watch, and like the video store was a cool thing, you know. And that's what's fun about like a show like Stranger Things, because I'm watching that show and I'm like, that's exactly what I remember from that time period and like what everybody was doing and how they looked and what they were watching and listening to.
Yeah.
You know, really, I thought really cool. But yeah, I guess, you know, out of all the films, I think The Shining probably for me would be the one that I would definitely go back to as far as it being one of my favorite horror films of all time.
I think I might have been just the very end of the video store age. Remember as a kid, we used to, there was one in the grocery store and like, we'd go in there, like you were saying, like I'd see a scary cover. I remember Lake Placid was one in particular that had a big crocodile head on it that I always wanted to get. And that's how I would pick the movies out. But by the time I graduated high school, it wasn't even there anymore. Like the store didn't exist. They had torn it down.
Right.
So
I ended up working in a video store for a while, but that was after I'd gotten out of college. And yeah, you get exposed to all that great stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember one film, I don't remember the name of it. Barbara Hershey was in it. I think it was called The Entity. Did you ever see
I've
that?
Heard of that.
It's based on a true story, and it's about a woman who is attacked repeatedly, I guess, you know, raped as well, by this entity, and these paranormal investigators come in and they set up shop and they try to, you know, get footage and coverage of it, and all hell breaks loose. And apparently, you know, she was never able to get rid of the thing that kept attacking her, and they weren't mm-hmm. sure if it was something that was you know, psychological, or, you know, if something actually was really happening. But they have some really weird, they had some weird evidence on film. Now, it might be completely debunked now, I don't know, but I remember that was one of those films that I watched growing up and thinking, and I would never have seen, the only way I would have seen that film was if I, you know, I liked the cover that was the VHS cover for the, you know, at the rental store.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Blair Witch for me. That was what got me hooked, and hearing about my friends talk about it, like saying it actually happened, and my family was big into hunting and stuff. So
when did you see Blair Witch?
I think I was 8 or 9. Came out in 99. Yeah, so I was born in 91. So yeah, somewhere 8 or 9, somewhere right in there.
I saw it in the theater in New York when it opened.
Did you really?
Yeah. And it was a weird experience because, I mean, I had never seen a film like that.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, blew me away because it was like, I guess it was kind of like the first found footage film, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Although Ben Rock retweeted an article from the New York Times talking about the 20th anniversary of Blair, mm-hmm. and they were trying to say the Cannibal Holocaust was the first found footage film. No, and I'm, he was not letting them get away with that.
that's cool. Yeah, that interesting. I'd have to take a look at that as well. But I remember being in the theater and the mixed, you know, the audience was definitely like half the audience was really into it,
mm-hmm.
and the other half was like, "What the hell is this?" They didn't like the shaking of the camera, and it was starting to make people sick. So I think a lot of the audience left. But those of us that stuck around, I thought it was just the greatest thing ever. And I remember when I went into the, you know, in the lobby of the theater, they had, you know, like the things that were hanging from the trees, like the, and all that.
Oh, the effigies?
Yeah. And they had like photos and they just made it a really immersive experience.
That's so cool.
but at the time, like they still were kind of quiet about, you know, that this was not an actual thing.
Mm-hmm.
So when you walked in, you're like, oh shit, this is like a really well thought out, you know, this is like, oh my God, it's like walking into like a documentary, you know, it was really, really cool. And seeing all those artifacts and all the things was super clever. Whoever the branding guy at the market.
That was Ben Rock. Ben Rock was the architect mainly behind all that stuff. Yeah.
Unbelievable. I mean, super cool. No, yeah. I've never seen anything like that before. And you know, I was into pretty avant-garde stuff in New York. Mm-hmm. And that just blew me away. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, it stuck with me. Like, that's, like, I credit that one and The Faculty as the two movies that really got me as a kid to love horror.
Who was in The Faculty? Was that
Josh Hartnett, Frodo Baggins, Elijah Wood?
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Just was teaches Jennifer being Love aliens Hewitt and the smart movie? Nerdy kid being able to one to save the day. I was a fan of that.
Okay, cool. All right. That's another one I should probably check out then too.
It's good. We reviewed it for my birthday as a birthday special. We reviewed it and Justin didn't have the same kind of love that I did, but
nope.
It still has a special place for me.
So
how about, do you have a favorite horror novel?
The Stand, easy for me.
So what makes that your favorite? That's actually one of my least favorite Stephen King books, and I have all of them.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Well,
and there's one thing in particular that ruins that book for me, but we can hear why you like it first.
I read it when I was in college, and I remember my dad was a big Stephen King fan, so we had all the hardbacks, and I remember I took them all with me to college, and I rifled through all of them. I remember Cujo was another one that I really liked. Mm-hmm. I thought Cujo was the concept of that was amazing.
Yeah.
But as far as The Stand goes, I think what I really liked about it was the journey that everyone was taking together.
I agree 100%.
And for me, that was cool. Because I had at that point, I hadn't read, like, you know, The Lord of the Rings or any of those kind of, like, you know, adventure journey things with a group of people you know, doing it together. I hadn't really gone into that yet. And that was the first, and there's, you know, a couple of the characters I just, you know, kind of related to. I think Larry Underwood, I think was
yep, that's my favorite character.
Was the rock star, right? Mm-hmm. And I was a musician, and I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to be a rock star, and I, for some reason, I just gravitated towards that character more so than the Stu Redman character.
Yeah.
But I think there was just so many things about it that were so unique. You know, the walking dude, I think, is such an interesting character.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, the, can't remember what the name of the woman is.
Mother that, something.
Well, yeah, there's Mother Abigail, and then there's the woman, Nadine Cross. I thought Nadine Cross was a really cool character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when they made the miniseries, I was so excited. And have you got, yeah, I'm sure you guys have seen it,
yes.
Right? Yeah.
I have, actually. Yeah,
it's a bit of a letdown.
Yeah, it is.
To say the least. But there's some cool things that do happen in it. And I thought I think the woman who played Nadine Cross was perfect in the miniseries. And I thought that, you know, some of the, Tom Cullen, the guy who played him, was perfect too.
Yeah.
But I'm excited to see the new version.
Yeah, they got Marilyn Manson supposedly playing Randall Flagg.
Really?
That's the, and he's for sure cast, and the rumor is that he's playing Flagg. Whether that's true or not, that's just what I've been seeing on like message boards, but he's definitely been cast in it.
Wow, that's crazy.
It's kind of crazy because he also is in the Young Pope, whatever that show is on HBO or Showtime.
Oh, yeah.
He's in that too, which is crazy. So,
wow, that's a really interesting choice. but I mean, it makes sense in a lot of ways. He is a creepy fucking dude.
Yes, he is.
You know, I think that, you know, with the way technology is now, and also, I'm hoping they're turning. It's going to be a miniseries, right? It's not.
That's what I've seen. Yeah, it's a TV miniseries. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, they'll do it justice. But I'd be interested to know, and you know, what your problem with
so. Standard. The first thing is it brings me in on such a hook. I'm a research scientist. I work at a cancer hospital. So the whole idea of a viral outbreak to me is just awesome. And it's just done so well, and the way King does it is great.
Right.
And like you said, you have all these characters who you just fall in love with as you're reading the book.
Yeah.
And then King gets tired or bored, or he has too many characters. And so to kind of thin stuff up, he even has admitted this, as far as I'm aware, he loads them all into that mall, and spoiler alert for anybody who hasn't read The Stand, he blows them all up and like kills half his characters.
Yeah, the hand of God thing.
And he said that was to literally just make his life easier as a writer.
Yeah.
And like knowing, because when I first read it, it didn't bug me, but knowing that now, it's like, oh, like it's, I don't know, it's like you... cheap, I guess, would be the way to say it. I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that. I agree, and you know, I felt like the whole the hand of God bit was a kind of a bit much.
Yeah.
But it was still my favorite horror book to read.
Mm-hmm.
It there was so much going on and so many cool characters and so many things happening that. For me, I just gravitated towards it.
I mean, I loved it enough. I mean, I still like it enough that when my fiance and I, we moved across the country from Ohio to Utah in December, and we listened to that on audiobook as we drove. So I still liked it.
Yeah,
it was really cool to like listen to that, because we were driving at like 2 o'clock in the morning. That's when we would leave. So pitch black, middle of Wyoming, nothing around, and you just have
that's
The Shining. I mean, The Stand to you, it was fantastic.
But you know what? There's another book that I really liked a lot too. It's not a Stephen King book, and I don't even know if it's really considered a horror book. But it's a pretty disturbing story. It's called A Simple Plan by Scott Smith, I think, is the author.
I think I've heard of that. What is that about?
It's about these three guys who they're out walking their dog in the woods, and they come across a downed airplane, and in the airplane is a body, and there's also a big duffel bag full of cash.
Mm-hmm.
And they decide to keep the cash and try to keep it quiet, and things just start to unravel. And the way the book is written, it's disturbing in a way, like how awful human beings can really be.
Yeah.
You know, and how brothers turn on each other and things like that. And to me, I felt like that was dark story. I don't know if I would necessarily call it horror, but I would definitely call it horror. And there was a movie made, God, what's his name? Sam Raimi directed.
Okay.
I think it was one of the first films he did after the Evil Dead stuff. And it's a good film. It's got Billy Bob Thornton's in it, and Bill Paxton. And
I love Bill Paxton.
he's awesome in it.
Yeah.
The film is pretty good, but the book is better. And then he did another. The same author did another book called The Ruins.
I've read that one. That's when the campers go and there's a big circle around it. And they can't leave the circle because they're infected with something.
Well, no, they're exploring these ruins in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And they go into, I guess, like one of the, they go into a it's either a cave or some kind of opening, and they can't get out. And then the plant life starts to talk to them. Like, it's really weird.
Yeah. Okay.
Remember? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a weird one. It wasn't as good as his first book, though, but it's still pretty good. It's all right.
Do you have a favorite TV show?
Horror
TV show?
Well,
yeah. All right, fair enough.
one of my favorite shows that have come out recently is I thought it was great, was The Haunting of Hill House. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I love it.
And I thought it was just awesome. I'm on a horror TV show right now called Light as a Feather on Hulu. It's fun to be a part of a horror show. But I thought that The Haunting of Hill House, so well done, and I thought that the all the actors were amazing. You had an incredible cast. The story was great. I had never read the books, so I don't know how accurate they are to the book or to the previous film versions. But I was really impressed with how they told that story.
Mm-hmm.
And that series was not at all what I thought it was going to be, which was what was really cool about it.
Yeah.
That's what I really appreciated the most about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I'm really quickly falling in love with that director. He's doing Dr. Sleep.
Oh, cool. Right.
And he directed Gerald's Game
for Netflix. Okay, cool.
And I've talked about that several times on the podcast, but that's the last scary movie that I've seen that kept me up after I watched it.
Gerald's Game.
Yeah. It's got Carla Gugino. She's the main character.
She's incredible.
Yes,
and let me ask you guys this.
Uh-huh.
This is one of the things that me and my wife had an issue with The Haunting of Hill House. Every time she came on camera, it was like you had to adjust your eyes to how just beautiful she looked.
Yes. I've been in love with her since Spy Kids. When she was a mom in Spy Kids, I think that was probably my first crush with someone on TV.
Yeah.
And then she was in Watchmen.
Yep.
Yeah.
And had that awful scene to watch her go through. And that was terrible. I hated that. But I don't know. Every single time I see her in something, she's just so good. She was in Entourage. And she was awesome in that.
Yeah, she is a fantastic actor, and she is incredible in The Haunting of Hill House.
Yes, she is.
But it takes a minute for you to adjust, because she's got that face that is just so. She's just so beautiful that it literally, for me, sometimes it took me a little bit out of the story. I had to kind of readjust.
Yeah.
My focus. Yeah, I thought that show is really clever. I love how they use things like addiction and suicide, and I loved the family dynamic of it. It felt very real to me.
Yeah.
you know, the siblings all had their own thing going on, nothing felt out of place. Everything felt really grounded to me about that show.
Yeah, that we've only reviewed one TV show season so far on the podcast, and it was a listener request. And I don't know, like that, it's just so different. Like, Stranger, I haven't seen season three of Stranger Things, and Stranger Things is good, don't get me wrong, but Haunting a Hill House was just different in the best of way.
I totally agree. I felt like the last season of Stranger Things was better than the second season,
and that's what I've been told. Cause I had some problems with the second season because it felt like to me for a couple of those episodes they were trying to like prep spinoffs, and I
don't know. Really?
Well, when she went to go meet her siblings or the other numbers that were
part of the thing. that was the thing that bothered me the most, like separating everybody and like having her go off and be a part of another like group. It didn't work for me. I mean, it was still good, but it just didn't feel right to me.
I'm glad it wasn't enough Winona either, in my opinion, but that's personal.
Okay. Right on.
All right, so next question.
Yeah.
What is your favorite horror monster? And monsters in quotations. Like, for example, mine is Michael Myers. Okay. And Justin's is the creature from It Follows.
Okay. I kind of have to go old school with Frankenstein.
Perfect. Why is that?
Because it's so iconic. And one of my favorite movies ever is Abbott and Costello Meet the Monsters.
Okay.
And what I love about it is, you know, Abbott and Costello do their comedy thing.
Mm-hmm.
But all the monsters play it totally straight. And that's what makes it so perfect. And, you know, Boris Karloff as Frankenstein, to me, he was so perfect.
Yeah.
And it's such a heartbreaking story, too, at the same time. Frankenstein is a heartbreaking story.
Yeah.
And the way...
Especially the book. The book is very... I remember reading that in high school, and it was like, I was shocked at how sad it was.
Oh, totally. Yeah, and that maybe I'm wrong about this, and I hope that I don't get harassed about it. But was Frankenstein? Did Mary Shelley write that book on kind of a bet?
I'm not sure about that, but it was Mary Shelley's book, and it was more of her way of, from what I remember from high school English. I hope I don't get hell too. It was like her trying to like pervert the idea of the romantic gothic horror.
It's a perfect gothic horror story.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can get any more gothic than that, really. I guess you could, that movie always had a big impact on me. And I was scared. The other movie I was always scared to death of The Witch and The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, why is that?
That scared the crap out of me as a kid.
I always thought Wizard of Oz was boring.
Yeah,
as a kid, I didn't like it. Like that one and Sound of Music. And I liked musicals and I acted and stuff. Not to your level, obviously, John. But I did do some stuff. Like I was in speech and debate and everything. But yeah, Sound of Music and The Wizard of Oz are two movies that I just think are boring as paint drying.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Man.
Interesting. Well,
like I can appreciate them for what they are.
You're voted off the island.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, for me, I think what scared me about The Wizard there was a lot of things about The Wizard of Oz that scared me as a kid. I didn't like the fact that she took the dog away. That really scared me.
Yeah.
Also, the trees scared the shit out of me.
Oh, the trees are terrifying.
and the flying monkeys, man. I mean, that's pretty terrifying stuff.
You know where the uniform for the flying monkeys came from? A little bit of trivia for you guys. They're based off of West Point cadets' uniforms.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
Because they were supposed to film the movie at West Point or something, and they threw them away. Like they told them they didn't want them doing it there. And so the costume designer, despite the academy, designed them after the cadets.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
And if you go to any Army Navy game, the Navy cadets will whoop at the Army team, making the monkeys, like the monkeys whoop whoop.
There's
some Army Navy trivia for you.
Okay, well, I didn't know that. I'm a big football fan too, so that's, I like college ball, so that's my.
I spent 2 years at West Point, so.
Oh wow!
I got to learn all that fun stuff.
Right on.
All right, and then the last question before we get into more about you and learning about you as the actor.
Okay.
What is your least favorite trend in the horror genre? And for example, mine is like the rise of torture porn. And Justin's, funnily enough, is...
Oh, well, that's exactly what I was going to say. I don't like that.
Yeah.
I don't find it scary. I find it... I don't know. I just don't think it's... I don't know who could sit through that shit.
Is there a film that you could maybe give a pass to, like,
maybe,
for example,
maybe I should call it shit. I'm sorry to say that.
No, it's fine. No, because like
I don't want to piss off anybody who actually likes those films. But I've got a 12-year-old, and there's something about when you have a kid, like you're kind of things change, and your way of looking at things are different. Maybe I would have enjoyed that like when I was younger, but I can't get behind those films.
Yeah, because I think for me, I loved Saw, and Saw 2, well, although it went...
The original one was pretty like groundbreaking in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah,
I never saw.
And if you look back at that film now, it's not like James Wan's movie is not what the franchise became.
Okay.
It's much more of a murder mystery suspense thriller.
Let me see. Now that's interesting to me. You know, like that kind of thing is interesting.
Then Eli Roth, who I kind of give credit to the real rise of the torture porn, I liked Cabin Fever. Like I thought that was, have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't.
Four or five friends go up to a cabin in the middle of nowhere, and this viral outbreak breaks out, and it causes them to, like, their skin starts falling off.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So
that's
there's a lot
an
of
Eli
that
Roth
kind of...
film?
Huh?
That's Eli Roth?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
But then he followed that up with Hostel. And that was special. And then he followed that up with Green Inferno.
Yeah.
Which is the only movie that I've ever almost walked out of because I felt sick. The graphic nature of it. So I don't like for me, like there's some stuff like body horror definitely has its place, but when it gets to the point of like the gratuitous nature of a Hostel or the later Saws, it's just not there for me.
Yeah. And you know, I like the idea of like, if you look, like if you go way back to like Edgar Allan Poe and like The Pit and the Pendulum,
mm-hmm.
that's kind of like torture porn in a way.
Yeah.
You know, but the way that story's told, and I don't know if you've ever seen the film version of it.
Yeah, with Vincent Price.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
It really is, because it is just suspenseful, and it's just, you know, and there's just dread. You just have this feeling of dread. Mm-hmm. With these, you know, with I just can't stomach those films. I just can't. Yeah, I have a hard time with that.
You should definitely check out Gerald's Game. If you like Pit and the Pendulum, you like Carlo Giugino. It's based on the Stephen King book, and basically a woman and her husband go to this remote cabin, and they're having marital problems,
mm-hmm.
and they get kinky, and he ties her to a bed, or he cuffs her to a bed, then he has a heart attack and dies.
Oh, wait, no, I did see it.
Okay, so yeah, the Moonlight Man.
Where the dog comes in the room and all
Justin
that?
Justin hasn't seen it yet, so don't spoil it for him, but yes, 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 yeah, yes.
It's fantastic, and she, that's.
Like her dialogue with herself the whole time.
It's just another reason to love her. She's just okay. Yeah, no, I did see that. I forgot that that's what that was. Thank you for reminding me. Yeah, I did.
No problem.
Now I got to go.
I guess I really need to see this movie now.
Oh, yeah. No,
I love it. It's, like I said, it takes a special movie to scare me nowadays. And The Moonlight Man is, I think, forever burned into my brain.
Yeah. And that's what's great about Stephen King. The way he sets things up is just really, you know, he really knows how to do the setup. And,
I totally agree.
Yeah, I mean, he is the master. I remember I was reading his book, It's called On Writing. Have you read it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have it. Mm-hmm.
And it was entertaining to read it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a nice like guidebook on how to, you know, how to write. But it's also an entertaining read because he kind of delves into a lot of his backstory and how he kind of became who he was. I'm in the process now of creating I'm about to start pitching a pilot that I created. It's actually a horror time travel pilot.
Oh, fun.
And so I read his book, and to help me, you know, kind of, you know, get my skills up. My collaborator, my partner, her name's Carly Street.
Mm-hmm.
She's a very good, she's a very good writer. Her genre is horror. And, I don't know if are you guys Lance Henriksen fans?
I know who he is. Yeah.
Okay. She wrote a really great, film called Fragile Storm, which is it's a short film, but it's won tons of awards all over the world. And you guys would get a kick. I think you guys would really dig it. It'd be fun to talk about that too. In discussion, whenever you guys do your shows and stuff. But, we've collaborated on this project and we can talk about that too, if you want.
Sure.
But we're in the early stage. We shot a sizzle reel for it, and I can send you guys a link to that when it's done.
That'd be amazing. Yeah.
Kind of dig it.
Are you going to
it's a cool story.
Are you going to follow more of the Back to the Future time travel rules? Or are you going to use what Avengers Endgame did and just say, screw it, we're going to do weird stuff?
No, the kind of rules that we're using are basically you can't change the past no matter how hard you try. And that's kind of the crux of the whole story.
Okay.
The way the story goes, my character is a gangster in the 1930s, and he gets sucked into a time portal where he encounters, he goes to this place called the Dark Road, which is a dark cabaret circus, Wild West town area. Okay. Where all these people live. And they travel through time, and the more they travel through time, the more kind of screwed up they get. We just recently shot the sizzle reel for that, and we're about to start pitching it.
That's awesome.
Which is going to be a challenge because I've never done that kind of thing before. I'm pretty good with auditioning and that kind of thing, but I think, you know, pitching a TV show idea is a completely different animal, and, mm-hmm. Maybe somebody should write a horror film about that. I'm kind of dreading it, but we'll see how it goes. Yeah.
All right. So with that, then let's go ahead and get into you. And cool. We'll start off with your early life. So where did you grow up? Where did you go to school? What kind of led you not into acting? Because I guess I read your website, and your first big stint with show business was rock and roll, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up in a town in New Jersey called Chatham Township. And it's kind of a really quiet kind of, it's the kind of town where you could leave your bike out in the front yard.
And, oh, okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It was like, it was awesome because, you know, we could, you know, as kids, we would run around and, you know, basically the rules were as soon as the street lamps came up, it was time to come home.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had free range. I mean, we did whatever we wanted. And I grew up on the edge of what was called the Great Swamp, which is funny because in New Jersey, nobody ever thinks of New Jersey as being kind of rural. They all think it's industrial.
Yeah.
And the town that I grew up in, it was there were farms and there was, you know, a lot of country. And I lived on the edge of the swamp, and it was like this really dense, spooky, scary place.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bruce Springsteen sings about it in Born to Run, you know, somewhere out in the swamps of Jersey. That's basically, he's talking about the Great Swamp. And, you know, there's all kinds of legends about the Great Swamp where, you know, gangsters buried bodies out there. And And like New Jersey's an interesting place. You know, it was a really cool place to grow up because we were right in the middle of, you know, we had the, you know, we had mountains, we had the beach, and we had New York City. So growing up there was a lot of fun. And one of the things about New Jersey that was really cool is we would get all the New York radio stations, and that's where we would hear all the new. So like growing up in the 80s, every once in a while, like depending on how, you know, which way the wind was blowing, we would get radio stations that you normally wouldn't get that were playing all the best new music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like all the new wave bands that were coming out at the time, and like all the punk bands and all those things that were happening, which was fantastic. And so I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be in rock and roll bands. And I started playing bass guitar with a couple of neighborhood kids, and we formed a band, and I jumped around into different bands as I was growing up. And then by the time I was in high school, I was in a pretty solid band that we had two different shows. We would do whatever was kind of contemporary at the time, like a lot of like The Cure and REM and whatever, you know, at like a lot of college rock at the time.
Okay.
But then we also had our Grateful Dead show.
I saw that.
Which we would do an hour and a half. We would do an hour and a half of Grateful Dead covers. And that's pretty much how we made most of our money, because at the time the Grateful Dead became this huge thing again back in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And we all just kind of got into it and kind of jumped on the bandwagon and started playing their songs. And next thing you know, we were playing in New York City. So when I was like young, I was like 16 years old, I was playing in clubs in New York City.
That's awesome. And
like being an actor was like the furthest thing away from anything I wanted, because I didn't think that was possible. I thought mm-hmm. you had to be like a special person to be that kind of, to be an actor. I mean, I always wanted to be an actor. You know, ever since I saw Star Wars, I always wanted to be an actor. Mm-hmm. Or wanted to be in movies or act in movies. And but I felt like music was an easier kind of gig.
Sure.
I mean, nobody I knew was in Hollywood or acting, or even though, you know, New York City was just like, you know, a 30-minute, you know, train ride away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea of making movies or anything like that was, seemed like a million. You had to go to Hollywood to do that, is pretty much the way I always thought.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to be a musician. I was a musician, but I wanted to make a career out of it. But you fall into that trap of your parents, you know, not your parents, but like, you know, the everybody around you is going to college. So I thought, oh, well, I guess I got to go to college. So whatever college would take me, I decided to go to. And that's where I learned about theater, because it was kind of a fluke. The head of the theater department was also, I guess, my counselor, and he wanted to know why I wasn't taking any of his theater classes. And I said, well, because I'm here to study, you know, music engineering, which at the time when I applied to the school, they had it. By the time I got there, it was gone.
Oh, wow.
Cut the program. And so the head of the theater department says to me, well, if you want, you can run sound in the sound booth during the plays. We don't have a sound guy. And I was like, that sounds cool. How much does that pay? Well, it doesn't pay anything, but you'll get like college credits. And I'm like, oh, well, that's cool.
Yeah.
Sign me up. And then as soon as I saw the first play, I was like, I want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kind of dove headfirst into theater and learning how to be an actor and working on classic, you know, plays and reading. Like this whole new world opened up to me where I was reading plays by these amazing playwrights that I knew nothing about. So for me, it was a brand new experience altogether.
And you kind of started honing those skills at Snow Camp Outdoor Theater, right? You want to tell you? I looked into it, and
that's a horror story.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked by that. So, do you want to tell our audience, who probably doesn't know what I'm talking about, what Snow Camp was?
I don't know. I don't know what it's like now, but back when I was there, and let me just say, first of all, it was my first gig as an actor coming out of college, and it was fantastic. We had a blast, but it was challenging at the same time because we didn't have basically it's an outdoor theater production of a reenactment of a Civil War, not Civil War, a Revolutionary War battle that happened in North Carolina between the British and the American forces, and also the Quakers were kind of mixed up in it. So my character in that play was, I had the lead role in that playing, what was the character's name? Thomas Hadley, I think was his name, where he was a pacifist who had to join the army, and he ended up having to fight for, you know, for freedom. And it was a big outdoor thing with lots of explosions and musket fire and live animals on stage and all kinds of stuff. It was cool. It was a lot of fun, but the living conditions were atrocious.
That's what I was reading.
they had us living in, literally, it looked like a haunted house that we lived in. They had us living in this house that had electricity, but it didn't have running water. The running water came from a garden hose from some other building, like down the road across the street. So that's where we got our running water for a summer. And it's hot as hell in North Carolina in the summertime. And like really sticky and hot. And you know, it's a bunch of college kids trying to put on a show. And so that was my first big gig. I got paid, I think, $96 a week, and there was nothing around us. So that $96 would go right back into the production because we had to buy food on site.
Oh my gosh.
Oh,
so basically they put a roof over our head, gave us money that would go right back into their production. The campground had like a little like kind of diner restaurant, and that's where everybody ate, you know, and that's where we spent all our money. And then we would drive like, you know, a half an hour to a gas station to buy beer at night. that was snow camp.
So but after your lovely summer there, you moved to New York, right?
Yeah. I went right to New York after that. And I ended up studying with Terry Schreiber, who is a master teacher. And that's where I really learned to kind of hone my craft as an actor. New York in the 90s was a magical place. You could be an artist in New York in the 90s and you could pay rent. You know, you'd have your crappy little, you know, job waiting tables somewhere, and you'd be working, you know, you'd be doing independent theater, and you'd be doing independent films, and every once in a while soap opera work. And there were lots of commercials that shot in New York, so I got a lot of commercial work when I was in New York, and that's where I really learned how to work on set. And the training in New York was fantastic. It was method-based training, so it was very intense. And I look back at those times and especially that working with Terry Schreiber, who's still alive and he's still teaching. He's amazing. Was super valuable. I met my wife there. That place really changed my life for sure.
Was there a short film during that time that you were in that kind of sticks out to you today? Like, yeah, you look back on like often?
Well, I did a bunch of short films for NYU. I don't know. I can't really think of anything that was sticking out. There was one film I did called Gone, which was a good film. It was kind of like a Ordinary People type of story.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of reinforced my... When you're an actor, it's weird. It's like, because you're always self-doubting, but it kind of reinforced me like, you know what? I can do this.
Yeah.
I think and coming away from that, I think that was the film I felt pretty good about.
Then you were also in some off-Broadway shows, correct?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, off-Broadway. I did a couple of plays at the school I was studying at, and then a couple of independent things here and there, a lot of, like, original stuff that, you know, you'd do for a weekend, and then that would be it, basically.
So then after your time in New York, you and your wife moved to Hollywood, right? And you kind of got a break into the big screen with Living and Dining, right? With Maureen Stapleton?
What happened was we were still in New York when I got cast on that film.
Okay.
So what happened with that was I got cast in that movie, and then we shot that up in the Berkshires in Massachusetts. And it's a kind of a coming of age kind of story about, you know, people that work in a tourist town, and they all work in a restaurant, and then tourist season's over, the restaurant's closing, and everyone has to get on with their life. And it's about everyone kind of saying goodbye to each other.
Sure.
Really, really sweet film. Very, very well done. The cast was fantastic. Maureen Stapleton, who's a legend.
Yeah, she was a G away from the EGOT.
Yeah, I mean, she's incredible. It was her last film,
and
unfortunately that film never got seen because it never got a distribution deal, because at the time those films were kind of out of fashion.
Okay.
And distribution companies just weren't interested in picking something like that up, which is a shame because it's a good film. But it gave me confidence to keep going. And then I got cast in this thriller called The Ticking Man.
Yeah.
Which, if you guys ever get the chance, and if you can find it, you know, you want a good laugh, have a look.
But you were leading man in that, though, right?
I was the lead actor in that film, and I'm on screen 95% of the time.
It's awesome.
It's kind of like it was an interesting concept. It's kind of a cross between the movie Phone Booth and Run Lola Run.
Okay.
It's about a guy who wakes up one morning and finds out he has a bomb inside him. And you know, when I took the gig, I was like, all right, I'm just going to take this gig because, number one, I need experience. And, you know, I need a paycheck. And, you know, there's a lot of things that kind of go into that. And I thought it would be fun to do. And it was a blast. We had a great time making the movie. I never thought anything would ever happen with it, but it ended up getting distribution all throughout Europe, South America, Asia, Australia, everywhere except for North America, which is a kind of a blessing. Because nobody I know has seen it, except for one guy who was in Taiwan who called me up and said, you're on my TV right now, and this movie's hilarious. but, you know, it was a good experience. You know, when you're a young actor, you got to take those kind of gigs and you got to figure yourself out. And it was like boot camp because, you know, when you're the only one on camera, you really learn really quick.
Mm-hmm.
That film taught me a lot. And it gave me the confidence to kind of keep going. That's the thing, you know, actors, you know, the confidence thing is like always kind of in flux. You're always like, one minute you're like feeling great. Next minute you're like, God, I'm never going to work again.
Yeah.
You know,
and then according to your bio on your webpage, you were almost Spider-Man. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, this is a cool story. it was, I think, close to one of my last years in New York. I get a call from my agent saying, go down and audition for this thing. I was like, okay, what is it? She's like, I don't really know. They're not really telling me much, but it's a cold read. Go down and audition for it. I was like, okay, cool. So I go down to the casting, and they give me the sides, and I was familiar. I love Spider-Man, so I knew exactly what it was as soon as I saw the sides, because mm-hmm. it was, you know, Peter and MJ, and I'm like, oh, this is Peter Parker and Spider-Man. And I auditioned, and it went really well. They called me back, and they said, we'd love to have you. Awesome. That sounds great. Awesome. They're like, come on down to the office and we'll show you around and we'll talk about what we're going to do. I still didn't know really what it was. I thought it was a film.
Mm-hmm.
And I get down there and I go down to Marvel offices in New York, and you know, I'm kind of like shell shocked. I walk in and there's all these artists' tables set up, and there's artists making the comics and coloring them. And it was like breathtaking, like seeing it like in front of you, like, holy crap.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing panels of comics that aren't out yet. This is amazing. And they bring me into the office. And at the time, there's a guy there, his name was Bill Gemmis. He was, I guess, the head of Marvel at the time. And what they were doing was they wanted to create the first web series on you know, the, this is like in the early 90s, like 96, 97. Well, that's actually like late 90s, but who cares? Anyway, so they're like, we want to do this this web series of Spider-Man called Spider-Man Spider-Cam. We want you to play Peter Parker. And I was like, holy shit, this is amazing. And the way they had it set up was, they were going to do like a comic that you would take your mouse and you would click your mouse over one of the panels, and then a QuickTime movie would open up of the scene. It's very like very kind of, you know, you think of it now, it's kind of archaic, but at the time it was like, oh, you know, this was like an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. They were going to do, nobody was doing this. And so Marvel was all in, and believe it or not, Trump Models was also all in on it too. So Mary Jane, MJ, was a Trump model.
Oh, wow.
Right. So it was really interesting. We shot the first episode and it was going great. Everything looked awesome. And then they pulled the funding because they were taking the money. And at the time, Marvel was going bankrupt.
Yeah. They had to dice and slice that thing up, and Disney's trying to put it back together.
Oh, yeah. And at the time, you know, they're like, okay, well, we could either, like, put all this money into this Spider-Man thing that they have no idea of knowing whether or not it's going to work, or they could put all their money into X-Men.
Yeah.
And it ended up going over there. And so they pulled the plug on that, which is cool, whatever, you know. I mean, mm-hmm. it was bummer, but at least I can say I was Peter Parker.
Selected. Were you ever in costume?
No. What they were going to do was, when he became Spider-Man, they were going to animate it, do CGI. Oh, okay. Which probably is a good thing that they never did that, because probably would have backfired on them, because at the time CGI really wasn't that great. Sure. But that was still a fun gig to be able to, you know, say, you know, hey, I was Peter Parker for a minute, selected by Marvel Comics.
That's awesome. So that's really awesome. So then you kind of took a break from acting, right, to be a dad.
Yeah, well, we moved out to L.A. After I did the Living and Dining and the Ticking Man, I was feeling pretty good about myself and thought, let's move out to L.A. and see what happens. And I came out, I did a couple little things here and there. I did an episode of Show 24, and then everything kind of fell apart. There was a bunch of strikes that happened. Unions went on strike out here, and then production kind of ran away from Hollywood. And it ended up going to like places like Vancouver and Atlanta, and it just kind of disappeared. So there wasn't a lot of work. And I was at that age where nobody really knew what to do with me, because I looked too young to play like a professional guy, and I looked too old to play like the college kind of guy, or like, you know, college graduate kind of guy. So I was in a very weird space. And I decided to take a break, and we got married, had a kid. And I spent 5 years raising my daughter with my wife, and by the time she was five, I was itching to work again, and I had some life experience behind me, so I decided to jump back in and start acting again. And then from there, I enrolled in a couple of acting classes, and then I created The Rolling Soldier, which is the web series that
I was... And that's what I wanted to talk about next, because on your site, you're talking about how was your agent or your acting coach who wanted to get away to reintroduce you to Hollywood, right? Yeah,
my acting coach basically said to me, because at the time, you know, my footage, it's funny, getting back to like VHS tapes, all my footage was on VHS tapes, which meant it was like dated and old and useless from all the films and TV and stuff that I did in New York. It was completely useless and nobody cared about it at all. So what I had, what he suggested to me was I should invent something for myself, create a character for myself, and then create a story around it, and just so I could have some kind of new footage.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what I did. So what I decided to do is I was like, all right, I'll get together with my acting friends in class and shoot a pilot, and see where it takes me. And the Rolling Soldier is basically a story about a washed up CIA assassin who gets injured in Afghanistan and wakes up 10 years later in the United States and finds out he's kind of on the run and he's being hunted. And people responded to it. When I showed the pilot, people were like, this is great. What happens next? And I was like, I don't know. So I ended up having to create seven more or six more episodes to kind of do a story arc. And I'd never directed anything or produced anything before. I've always just been an actor. And I had to figure it out. And we ended up shooting seven episodes in total. And not expecting anything to ever come out of it, it went around the world to web series festivals and won awards all over the world, which was shocking to me because I didn't know that there was a thing called web series festivals that actually, you know, it's very important now because a lot of shows are being developed because of these web series.
Yeah.
So it's a thing now, and like and there's a whole market for streaming services that are looking for content, and this is all new to me, and I didn't understand it at all, really. But it was the smartest thing I ever did, was creating my own vehicle for myself to get me out doing the kind of work that I wanted to do. I wanted to work on shows like, you know, like 24 or like Homeland or The Blacklist and shows like that.
But you did work on Blacklist, right?
And I did.
Yeah.
because of my web series. The director of the episode of The Blacklist that I worked on saw the pilot of my show and asked me to read for him.
That's so cool.
And it went great. And then I ended up, you know, working on The Blacklist, which was fantastic.
So where did you get the funding? And like you said, you were like director, writer, all these different roles. Like, so what was that like diving into that?
It was crazy. I don't recommend it. It was crazy because, you know, I had to act in it also, not only like do all the legwork to raise money and we did an Indiegogo campaign for The Rolling Soldier. But I had a friend foot the bill for the pilot. When we shot the pilot, we used the pilot as a pitch video for the Indiegogo campaign. And then we ended up raising money. You know, we raised a modest amount, you know, not much. We only raised about close to $7,000, I think. But we were able to really stretch that money out and make something cool. I look back at it now and I honestly really don't know how I did it. I thought I was going to go crazy when I was doing it because I was the writer, I was the director, the producer, and I was the star of the show. And then once all the episodes were shot, then we had to go into post-production. We had no money left at that point. So I had to teach myself how to do all the post-production work, which I was not good at.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, one of the hardest things in post-production is doing color correction on film. And that was the thing that almost like made me go nuts and become an axe murderer. because it was really, really intense and really hard. But, you know, I got through it. And, you know, and now, like, the lesson I learned from that was when I started out as an actor back in the 90s in New York, there was no way in hell you could ever make something on your own because it would cost an enormous amount of money because everything was still being shot on film. Now, with all these cameras and digital technology, there's no excuse for an actor or an aspiring director or whoever to go out and shoot something.
Mm-hmm.
If I could do it, anybody could do it. And it's kind of an empowering thing when you know you create something and then it gets noticed and then you're able to kind of develop work off of it and then people kind of look at you differently and take you seriously in a way that just being an actor is, you know, you don't get when you're an actor producer writer director, you kind of get a little bit more juice, you know. So
yeah,
that's kind of what happened with me with that. And then I was able to kind of roll it into doing other things, and I kind of reinvented myself with it, which was it was like I said, it was the best thing I ever did for myself in my career.
And it's awesome too, because you, like you said, you got multiple awards from festivals on it, which is even crazier to think that you did it all on your own.
Yeah, and I never expected it at all, ever. I had no idea that was ever any of that was going to happen. I just never thought that anybody would ever watch it to begin with.
Yeah.
And I literally created it so I had footage for my reel. It's basically why I did it, but it turned into a thing, and it's got a nice little fan base, and people keep asking me if I'm ever going to make more, and I would awesome. Love to, but I you know, money and life and things happen, and things kind of get it gets harder to kind of go back and do something like that. But yeah, it was a great experience being able to do that. I think any artist that's out there, hopefully listening, it'll give them inspiration to do it.
Yeah,
to do something on their own, for sure.
And one last note on that: we were talking a little before we started recording, but this was how you met one of our other guests, Bob DeRosa, right?
Right. Yeah, that's great. Bob has an amazing web series called 20 Seconds to Live.
Mm-hmm.
And we met in Vancouver at the Vancouver Web Fest, which was an amazing experience because they go all out. I mean, it is literally like the Academy Awards of web series. It's a trip. It's a trip. Like, they have celebrities giving out the awards, and there's a big gala, and there's all this stuff. And I got to meet Bob and hang out, and we actually lived very close to each other for a period of time. We lived in an area of Los Angeles in the Valley, and we would go to the same coffee shop, but we didn't know that we would frequent the same coffee place. And
mm-hmm.
eventually we ended up hanging out and having coffee together for a couple times. But he's a really interesting guy, and his web series is it's fantastic. And he's gone off to do bigger and better things. And he's an interesting guy. He's written a lot of stuff and done a lot of cool things.
Yeah. It was fun to talk to him about all that.
I think he wrote for, I can't remember what show it was. Name escapes me, but he's a great guy, and people mm-hmm. should definitely check out Bob for sure.
Yeah. So then kind of get into your current work, and this is how I saw, because my fiance watches Lucifer.
Yeah.
And so you were on that. Do you want to talk about your experience being on that show?
Yeah, Lucifer is the gift that keeps giving to me. I don't really know how else to describe it. I got booked on Lucifer doing basically, you know, it was a day player role. I play a cop who it's a dream. Well, it's not a dream sequence. If you watch the show Lucifer, you know there's a through line throughout the whole series. But every once in a while, they do these things called standalone episodes where
yeah,
this was basically a what if episode. What if these characters never met each other? And my character, I play a cop who is partnered up with Lauren German, who plays Chloe Decker on the show. And she gets killed. She's dying in my arms. We have this great dramatic scene. And then the camera pulls back and you discover that it's actually a movie within a movie.
Okay.
And it was a really fun scene to shoot. And that experience on that show was one of the best experiences I've ever had working on a set. I've never been a part of something where the cast and the crew really felt like a family and everybody was really working for each other and trying to make something great. And I felt that way when I was at the table read. The way that they treated me was fantastic.
Awesome.
And what had happened was that show got canceled.
Netflix picked it up, right?
Yeah, and this is where everything gets really, really weird and kind of and kind of fantastic. The show gets canceled. It was on Fox, and the episode that I shot was being held over for the following season, along with the cliffhanger. And they also shot a cliffhanger, basically thinking, well, we're going to end on a cliffhanger. We've got a couple of episodes that are already in the can, so Fox will re-up. And basically, they didn't. They said that we want the NFL. you guys are on the chopping block, which is a shame. So I hear about it getting canceled, and I get super pissed off. And then I go on to Twitter, and I had no idea that the show had such a humongous fan base that were so rabid and in love with this show. Mm-hmm. I didn't know. I really had no idea. And it's funny because I watched the show because I had to watch it to do research for the part. You know, I wanted to know what the vibe of the show was. So I got into it. I thought, well, this is a really fun show. And when the show got canceled, the Twitter community went absolutely apeshit.
Mm-hmm.
And started this whole hashtag save Lucifer campaign, right? To try to save the show. And because Brooklyn Nine-Nine got canceled also, and their fans, you know, raised hell too. And they got picked up by NBC right away because those fans did such a great job, you know, pulling together and getting the show. And the Lucifer fans were doing the same exact thing. And it went on for weeks. And I kind of jumped in and said, listen, my name is John. I'm in one of the episodes that was supposed to be for next season, but obviously there's not going to be a season.
Yeah.
If you guys need help, I'll help you out. And I woke up the next morning and I had like 4,000 new Twitter followers.
Oh my God.
It was like, what's going on? And so I got involved and I did my part and you know, kind of helped rally everybody and keep everybody enthused to save the show. And then it got picked up by Netflix. And here's what's really great about the fan base for this show. They appreciated my help so much that they nominated me for a best guest star role for E Online Scoop Awards.
Really?
Yeah. I got nominated for an award because the fans were so happy that I helped them. And I felt bad that the fans lost their show and I wanted to help them.
Yeah. You know?
And then next thing I know, I'm nominated against Neil Gaiman, Lin-Manuel Miranda, and all these people that are like, you know, like big legit stars and me. And it was just one of those magic. It was magic. I didn't win, but I came close. And it was all because of those great fans. That's a great group of people, you know. And it opened my eyes to how important fandom is to shows and how fandom is important just in general.
Yeah.
For anything, like whether it's horror or whether it's sci-fi or like Marvel or whatever the hell it is, you know, it's fans are the lifeblood of these shows.
Yeah.
And then Netflix picked it up and they did season, I guess, season four. And now they're about to do, I think, another season.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think it's done after that. But that was magic. And, you know, from that, I've been able to kind of, expand even more, which was a pretty amazing thing. So yeah, Lucifer, like I said, that was one of the best experiences I ever had. And, the fans are amazing. I love them to death. And the opportunity that I've gotten from that show has been really amazing.
And it's nice to hear too, because a lot of times Twitter can be quite the toxic hellscape.
Absolutely.
So it's always nice to hear when good things come out of there.
and you know, and I've experienced some things on Twitter, you know, there's a little bit of a backlash, like, who is this guy? Why, you know, why is everybody, you know, like, and I get it, you know, but you know, whatever. And I try to stay positive on Twitter, and I try to, you know, keep up with all those people that, you know, that followed me. And, yeah, it's an amazing thing. Like, I try to look at the good parts of social media. I try not to get involved in like politics and, you know, if I have something negative to say, I kind of keep it to myself.
Yep.
I don't want to get sucked in. And if I feel like I'm being baited into something, I try to avoid it for sure.
Yeah. Then you were also on, like we mentioned earlier, The Blacklist, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I shot The Blacklist before I did Lucifer.
Okay.
And like I said, The Blacklist was a direct result of my web series. And that was a kick-ass show to work on, man. That was a lot of fun. It was
James Spader is a hell of an actor.
Yeah, and he doesn't mess around. I wasn't in a scene with him, but he was on set because he's one of the producers of the show, and he's all business, man. He's no joke. Yeah.
And then you mentioned earlier on Hulu, you're on a horror show called Light as a Feather, right?
Yeah. It's one of Hulu's original shows. It's based on a young adult novel that's published on Wattpad, and it's a horror themed show. It's it stars Liana Liberato and Haley Ram, and some other, you know, big young actors are on that show. Jordan Rodriguez, Peyton List, and it's a good teen horror show. And I played Liana's father on the show, and I ended up doing three episodes, and they just wrapped season two. So hopefully, you know, season three comes around, maybe I'll come back and do some more.
But is it weird playing a dad on a show?
Yeah. Well, this is the first time I've played a role like this, because normally I play roles where I'm running around, you know, shooting people, or kind of like a guy, kind of like a reluctant hero type character. And in this, I'm just a dad, which is kind of cool, you know, because I never really thought of myself as ever playing those kind of roles. But as I get older, you know, I guess those opportunities are there.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I highly recommend it. You know, it's a fun show. The kids are great on that show. And
what's the premise?
Basically, the premise is a bunch of high school kids play light as a feather, stiff as a board.
Oh, okay.
It unleashes a curse on them, and one by one, they start dying. And and it's cool. But it goes deeper than just that. It really kind of goes into like the high school experience, not as much as like a show like Euphoria. But it goes into, you know, the experience, and it's you know, it's a fun show, and it's doing pretty well on Hulu right now. So it's nice to be a part of something that's kind of a hit.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And then I also saw on IMDb that you have a feature role in Redway Manor.
Yeah, Redway Manor was a it's a VR kind of choose your own adventure film that you can watch with a head, you know, you got to wear like an Oculus headset or one of those things. And yeah, that's a murder mystery with kind of like it's got some spooky stuff going on. That was a challenge because when you shoot a VR movie, I don't know if you're familiar with that technology at all, but you can't it captures everything. So the crew has to hide all over the place mm-hmm. while the cameras are, you know, picking up everything else that's going on in the room. so there's nowhere to hide, you know? So you're always kind of have to be engaged as an actor with what's going on. And
mm-hmm.
That was a challenge. That was not an easy shoot, but it was fun. If you're into VR, that, you know, it's a cool kind of choose your own adventure story. I mean, I don't have one, so I haven't seen it.
Oh, really?
No, I haven't seen it. So I'm dying to know how it is.
What's coming up for you, and like, what's the next big things on the horizon?
Well, right now, I'm involved in a film called The Reservation, which is a horror film about an archaeologist and a bunch of people that are trying to find an ancient Native American artifact, and the artifact is cursed, and the closer they get to it, the more insane they go. And I'm actually the bad guy in the film, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, nice. Is it your first time playing the bad guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is super exciting for me, 'cause I get to, you know, really go for it. We've been shooting it kind of in bits and pieces. Like, anytime you do an independent film, it's really hard to knock it all out in one shot. So we've been kind of spacing it out, trying to do it when we can.
Sure.
And we're supposed to pick up again in October, and hopefully, we'll be able to shoot the majority of what we need that's left to shoot. That's the idea. Okay. But it's a fun script. It's got a good cast. Michelle Martin is in it. She's done a couple of horror films. Kelsey Bolin is in it. She was on Twin Peaks. Nick Wolf is in it. Who else? That's basically like the gist, like those four characters lost in the California wilderness going mm-hmm. insane. So should be fun. Cool. I'm excited. I mean, yeah, I'm excited to tear into it and finish that film. And the other thing that I'm doing is a project I've created with my partner Carly Street called Dark Road, mm-hmm. which is a time travel horror premise that we're trying to pitch as a pilot. And I can't really talk too much about it, but we shot a sizzle reel, and we are almost done with the sizzle. We also have a short film version, a graphic novel, and the pilot script that we're going to start taking out and pitching.
Are you excited for that process? Or what is your feeling going into that?
Well, it's a new experience, like pitching a show. I've never had to do that before. So that I'm terrified of, but I'll have to figure out a way to get through it. And yeah, I'm excited about it because I think it's good. I think it's really good. I think the concept is original. I think that there's an audience for it. And I our concept artist and the team involved that we've been working with is amazing, and I think we have something really, really good. And I'm really hoping somebody will grab it, because I think there's something there.
So what's that process going to be like? Because my only real knowledge of that would be from Entourage. So it will be you and Carly going into a room with execs trying to make a statement?
I would love Carly to be with me, but she's in London.
Okay.
So it's probably going to be me doing most of the legwork in LA, and you know, hopefully she'll be able to do some in London, maybe pitch it to the BBC and some of those channels. Yeah, I mean, you're probably right there with me and not knowing what would happen. So like it's going to be an experience, and you know, I'm hoping that somebody will snatch it, because I think it's a good idea. I think there's something there, and I'm excited to share it with you guys. Well, you know, when I get some footage, I'll share it.
We would love to share their audience too. I'm sure they'd love to check it out.
Yeah, I think
you'll dig. Obviously, we wish you the best of luck. That sounds absolutely terrifying.
I'm totally scared to death. But, you know, we'll make the best of it and see what we can get.
So then one last thing before we let you go. We wanted to do something a little bit different. We wanted to talk to you in hypothetical terms about if you could be in a slasher movie, what kind of positions would you take? Yeah, so the first question is, would you rather be like the slasher, or would you rather be like the final girl archetype, like the survivor?
I want to be the final girl archetype, but I have to wear roller skates.
Okay.
I don't know. I think I've always kind of, well, I mean, it's funny because I'm playing kind of the slasher role in The Reservation. But I've always wanted to be the hero and things. So I guess I would want to be, yeah.
You try for the anti-hero role, right?
That's more my vibe. I'm more like the reluctant hero guy. But yeah, that would be fun.
All right. And then here's a hard one, all right?
Okay.
Which slasher of the iconic slashers would you think you would do best going up against one-on-one, and then which slasher do you think that you would fare worst against going up against one-on-one?
I think I would probably have a really hard time against Freddy Krueger.
Yeah, so that's a fair one,
because he's got so much going on with, like, you know, the dream manipulation, and that would be hard to do. Who's slower, Michael Myers or Jason?
Man, they're close. Jason has a much more supernatural vibe to him. Yeah. Like, they kind of did that with Michael, but then they scrapped that real hard, the Call to the Thorn. That didn't stick around very long.
Yeah.
So I would say probably Michael, since Jason has that supernatural.
Yeah, I guess I would maybe I'd have to take my chances against Michael Myers. It depends. I mean, you know, if I'm on a boat, then I don't know. I mean, Jason would get me on the boat, wouldn't he?
Yeah, so happened at the end of the first one. He wasn't even in the movie until the very end when he popped out of the water.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'd have to say, Michael Myers for sure.
Okay.
That's such a funny question. That's so nice.
All right, and then next question.
Yeah.
What modern horror director would you most like to work for? If you could pick one who's making horror films right now, so like you have Peele and you have James Wan and you have Flanagan, you have all these guys, which one would you pick to work for?
I don't know the director's name, but there was a film that I saw recently called Under the Skin. I don't know if you guys have seen that.
I have.
Oh, it sounds familiar.
That movie shook me badly. I don't know how other people react to that film, but I would want to work with that guy because I feel like his visual images and the way that he created suspense was kind of masterful, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. So you saw that film, right?
Yeah.
That scene with the kid, the baby on the beach.
Yes.
Is I'll never forget that scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that they did the bodies exploding in the water.
You should check it out, Justin.
I'll never forget that either.
Sounds great.
it's a disturbing film.
Yeah.
Not because it's gory or you know there's any kind of like shock value to it, but it's disturbing in a way that's like just the kid on the beach. I just can never get over that scene. Mm-hmm. So I'd want to work with that guy.
Okay, perfect.
I think that guy
and
is
then which horror director from just the history of cinema? I want to exclude Kubrick for this, just because I think that probably, if he's your favorite, I want to just take him out of the equation. But of the famous horror directors like your Cravens and your Toby Hoopers and all of them, which one would you have liked to work for most?
Well, I think John Carpenter, probably.
That's a good choice.
You know, I mean, that first Halloween film is so incredible.
Yep.
I mean, my favorite, one of my favorite scenes ever is when she's in the closet and he's breaking through the closet door. That there's something about that scene that is just so frightening and just so, like, the way the light is swinging and, you know, just everything that's going on in that scene just is magic to me as far as horror goes. But yeah, I think John Carpenter, plus I like the Thing is a great film.
Yeah, for sure.
So, I mean, I think he would be the one I'd want to work with.
All right. So branching out a little bit from horror.
Okay.
If you could pick any director to work with, past or present, which one would you most like to work with?
Well, let's see. I mean, contemporary directors, I'd like to work with Danny Boyle.
Okay.
His movies to me are just fantastic.
He's actually got our top rated film right now, 28 Days Later.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the motion in his films and like Trainspotting is one of my favorite films. I'd like to work with him.
Sunshine blew me away. That was one of the.
Isn't that a great movie?
It is incredible, and it's so hard to describe how good it is as a movie.
It's such a good movie, and nobody saw it.
Yeah.
And what's even better about that movie is the soundtrack.
Yes, John Murphy kills it. Absolutely kills it.
And I actually have a copy of that soundtrack. And I've got Underworld. Are you familiar with the electronica band Underworld?
No, I don't think so.
They did a lot of the music for they work with Danny Boyle a lot.
Okay.
Like Trainspotting, like a lot of that techno stuff is okay. Underworld. I'm a big fan of theirs, and they did a whole bunch of music for Sunshine that I have also that I'm not supposed to have, but somehow I have it. so yeah, I mean, that's a great film, and like Danny Boyle for me is an amazing director, and I love the speed of his films. And but I'm trying to think who else I would really like to work with. Paul Thomas Anderson would be another one I'd like to work with. Or David Fincher.
Fincher would be awesome.
Yeah, for
sure.
The
first movie I saw of his, I might have seen Seven when I was a kid, but I think it might have just went right over my head because
Seven was another movie that I couldn't stop thinking about after I saw it.
Yeah.
That movie was disturbing to me also because you weren't seeing what was happening.
Yeah. Cause I think I saw it as a kid, and the only thing that like really stuck with me then was the fat guy with the head in the soup. Like that was the only thing I remember seeing. But when I watched it again recently, it was a whole different experience.
Yeah.
But the first Fincher film that I saw that really kind of like took me back was Social Network, because I thought that the entire premise was just dumb. And then you watch that movie, and it's like, holy crap!
it's kind of a boring story, and he makes it pretty electric. You know?
Oh my god! Yeah.
That and the Steve Jobs film,
mm-hmm.
You know, and because I think Aaron Sorkin was the writer for those films.
Yes,
like,
he was.
That has a lot to do with it. But Fincher is such an amazing filmmaker. I actually auditioned for the second season of Mindhunter.
Did you really?
Yeah,
I love that show.
Yeah, I auditioned twice for that, and I had to put myself on tape doing a monologue. I don't know if I can talk about it because it hasn't aired yet.
Yeah.
But it's some of the best written stuff that I've ever had the chance to, you know, chew on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Mindhunter is an amazing show. That show is just kick ass. Can't wait.
It's Charlie Manson season two, right? Isn't it the same actor who played him in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood's bringing on Charlie?
I honestly have no idea. I don't know. That's the case. I'm excited.
All right. And then one last question. This one might be hard. And I'm not a big fan of remakes. So I'm not asking you to remake a movie. But if there was a role that you saw that you would love to put your spin on or to do your own interpretation of it in any like classic Hollywood film or modern Hollywood film built like The Departed or even something like Apocalypse Now? Is there a role?
Those are two movies I love, by the way.
Okay. is there a role that, like, in your perfect dream scenario, you could take on and then you would just like to try it for yourself?
You know, I think The Fugitive would be a film that I'd want to do.
Harrison Ford's character?
Yeah, I think The Fugitive is something that I really would do well and gravitate towards. Or Beastmaster. It should be fun. No, I don't have the body for Beastmaster, but yeah, I think The Fugitive would be.
You got CGI. They made De Niro like 50 years younger for The Irishman. They can.
Did you see that? It dropped today, didn't it?
Oh yeah, I'm excited. I posted on Twitter like I got a Tarantino and a Scorsese in the same year. If they give me Inarritu, I'll just be a really happy camper.
Oh wow, yeah. What's he working on?
I have no idea. Like after The Revenant, I haven't heard anything.
I was watching Birdman and
Revenant back to back, and now it's like nothing.
I was watching one of those Hollywood Reporter roundtables with directors, and he was talking, and he basically said that he was so incredibly burned out from doing both of those films back to back that, you know, he's like, I'm just gonna sit back and kind of take a break. Well, I can definitely
believe it. I mean, Birdman blew me away. Like, my fiance hates the movie, but how it's shot is one continuous take, and then Michael Keaton, who I just love as an actor from Batman to Beetlejuice, like, he's just my guy. And he's amazing. And then Revenant, I love Leonardo DiCaprio. And
I thought Revenant was fantastic.
Just that opening scene I was hooked, just ready to go. Yeah. And I would love to, I want to see more. So that's why I did. That's why I posted that. And then one last question, just kind of curiosity question. Who has been your favorite actor you've bumped into? Or actor, actress, director? Like who in Hollywood have you ran into, met, talked with, had a coffee, something like that, that you just kind of still to this day pinch yourself like, I met that person?
Well, it just happened kind of recently.
Okay.
I went to a dinner party and I got to it was like a dinner slash pool party, and I got to talk to Thandie Newton from
Westworld.
And had an amazing conversation with her, and she's super down to earth. And I kind of walked away from that pinching myself, like, oh my God, I was looking at. We were in the pool talking about Star Wars. It was pretty amazing.
That's so cool.
It was pretty cool. That's the most recent experience I've had. But as far as other experiences, I have to think about that. I had an experience with Paul Newman that I'll never forget. I was working in a cafe in New York City, and it was like a cafe restaurant. I was in the cafe part of the restaurant, and it was around 10 p.m. at night. It was on the Upper East Side, and it's kind of quiet, and we could hear this screeching sound coming from the street. We're like, what the hell is that? We see this car go flying by, spin out, and then go flying by again, driving the opposite way down the road, and then it wheeled in and parked in front of the restaurant. No, this is all happening in front of the window, and we were like, "Who the hell is that?" And in walked Paul Newman, and we're just like, "Holy shit!" And he walked past us, and he kind of gave us that like you know that gesture with like your finger and the gun, to us, and went in and sat down with his wife, who was, I guess, having dinner. That was a pretty cool experience. That was one of the coolest experiences I've ever had, to be honest.
That's awesome. That's the end of the interview. John, do you want to plug your stuff? Tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. You guys can find me on Twitter at John J Tag. It's spelled JohnJTague. It's the same handle on Instagram. I always try to follow everyone back, so if you give me a follow, I'll follow you back. I'm not like Facebook isn't really my jam anymore, but
same here. We have a page. I just post episode every Monday.
Cool. Well, I'll make sure I share it. But yeah, if you want to follow me on Facebook, my actor's page on Facebook is just John Tag Actor. You can find me there. But yeah, Instagram and Twitter at John J Tag is where to find me. And this was really great. Thank you so much for
I said it was kind of serendipitous, and I missed 100% of the shots you don't take. So I just, when you said that, I was like, all right, do you want to come on? And you said, sure.
Yeah,
so
it was
perfect.
Sure.
Worked out.
Sure. And, you know, best of luck to you guys. It's a fun show. I've listened to a couple of episodes and I'm really digging
it. It's just
a
hobby. Like I kind of said, it's fun to talk to people we would never have talked to before. So it's a blast. I love talking to people.
Yeah, right on. And, you know, anything I can do to ever help you guys out, please don't hesitate.
That's amazing. Thanks, John. Justin, we have finished our first mini season.
Is it? Yeah. And I guess we're going to play the teaser at the end of this for the next season, aren't we?
Yes, the next season, I'm not sure if you can call it a mini season because there's a lot of different
things.
It's pretty big.
Yeah.
It's pretty big. It is a season close to my heart.
No, I actually wanted to ask you this. I feel like it is also, it's not a mini season because there's a lot to it, but I also feel like we're in that time of year where all these movies are coming out.
Yeah, and it kind of gives us time to hit the new movies, hit some stuff we need to hit before stuff comes out.
Yeah.
But also spend time with this franchise that, to me, got me just hooked at a young age into the horror genre. And that's my little hook. We're going to, before our outro stuff plays, we're going to play the little teaser for it.
I think if you've listened to the show long enough, you probably already know what it is before I even play it now.
Yep. Next week, we'll break it down what it's going to be. But Justin, anything else to add?
No, nothing.
All right, guys. Well, until then, enjoy the hook and stay scary. Here's Johnny Podcast is brought to you by Larry and Justin. You can find the show on Twitter at Here's Johnny Cast, and you can find Larry at Beaver LA.
You can find Justin at Pickle Thing, and you can email the show at heresjohnnypodcast@gmail.com. You can look us up on Facebook at Here's Johnny Podcast.
As always, in the show notes, you can find links to the Discord and to the website. We are also on Instagram at @HeresJohnny_podcast.
Also in the show notes, we'll have a link to the Twitch and YouTube channels. And if you would like to support the show, you can head on over to patreon.com/HeresJohnnyPodcast. Every cent goes into the show. And yeah, we just really use it to make the show better. Again, I just want to say thank you very much to our patrons. You guys help make this possible.
But yeah, Patreon is the way we support the show. We aren't looking to get rich. And like Justin said, every dollar, every cent, it all goes back in. There's some pretty cool tiers, so head on and look at that.
But until next week, see you guys later.